Accession number 16252, Reel 1.
Brigadier Smallman, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in York.
Which year was this?
In 1915.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was an army schoolmaster.
Did you go to school in York?
No. We went from York to South Africa immediately after the war. We then went to India, and I came back to this country from India when I was aged 11, and I came to school here in Farnham.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
I was 18.
And then you did what?
And then I went up to university. I went to King's College, London, to read English, journalism and military studies.
Which year did you finish that?
Well, I finished that when I joined the army in 1939. I came down without taking a degree because war was inevitable, so I finished my studies. I was in the University of London OTC. I was RSM of the Infantry Battalion. I applied for a university commission. I was told that the only corps in the army that was looking for commissioned officers at that time for the universities was the RESC, so I went from Regimental Sergeant Major of the Infantry Battalion to a Driver ASC of the Army Service Corps Company. And from there, I was commissioned into the RESC in Aldershot.
What was your reaction when you heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
Well, to some extent it was expected, because, of course, that's one of the reasons why I came down to the university. But to some extent, it was a relief, because it was something which was building up. And in those days, one was young, one didn't fully understand or appreciate what the outcome might be, and it was to an extent, it was relief. At last, we knew what we were going to do.
Now, I think you went abroad with the BEF. Can you tell me how that came about, please?
Well, on the 25th of September, I sailed from Southampton, Cherbourg, to join the BEF, but previously to that, I was on the young officers course at Aldershot, which finished prematurely because of the outbreak of war. I was involved to some extent then in the mobilisation of the rear headquarters of the British Expeditionary Force, which was carried out at Maeda Gymnasium in Aldershot, and then I was sent to Salisbury Plain to form part of an organisation called 2 GHQ Artillery Company, which was an artillery support company providing petrol supplies and ammunition for GHQ artillery regiments. And it was in that guise that I went to France. We'd had one or two interesting things before we set sail, one of which was we took on a lot of reservists, gunner reservists, and when we cross-examined them as to what their background was, they all said they were drivers RA. We assumed they could drive lorries. We found, in fact, they were all people who could drive horses, so we had to use them for other purposes. And, of course, we had impressed vehicles, and most of the vehicles had to be camouflaged very quickly, and two of the vehicles were Hartley Gem, what you might call roller-top back-door jam lorries, and these went to France with their camouflage paint still revealing underneath Hartley's jams, because Hartley's jams paintwork was very strong. We got to France in very fine weather. We were able to drive up through from Cherbourg to Arras, where we were located, mostly in glorious sunshine, sleeping by the roadside on the way up. It was altogether a rather pleasant procedure. It was only later, of course, we discovered that life in France, pending the outbreak of operations, life in France was going to be rather unexciting, dull, and to some extent demoralising.
Why demoralising?
Well, because we didn't feel at that time that we had a task to do. It was just a daily routine, almost peacetime task of taking ammunition supplies and petrol up to various units in the front line. And the troops were billeted in barns. There wasn't a great deal of entertainment for the troops. And so one really felt that it was about time that something happened. Either the war should start or we should call it a day and come home.
What were relations with the French civilians like?
Relations with the French civilians in our part of the country were not all that good because, of course, most of the men were away in the French army, and they resented the fact that their womenfolk they thought were at risk from the British occupying forces. It was a very it was a socialist part of France, of course. A lot of Polish miners, a lot of the mines up there, and so there was a certain amount of disapproval of the fact that we had gone to war, or they had gone to war, and that we were at war with on their side, and so they were not exactly in support of the British being there.
Do you remember any remarks which were passed to you of that kind?
No, but I do remember some of the troops complaining that they had threatening remarks made to them when they entered pubs and restaurants and places of that sort. There was a local dance hall in the town that we were occupying, and a number of the troops complained that if they were dancing with the French girls, they came in for a certain amount of rudery, and in one case, a soldier was actually attacked because he was dancing with some chap's girlfriend. He was home on leave, and he found this soldier dancing with his girlfriend. So it wasn't all that a happy situation at that time.
What was the name of this town?
A place called Liévin, just outside Lens. And, of course, Lens is very much a coal mining area.
Did you see anything of the French army or the French military forces generally?
We had an extremely good French liaison officer. Well, he wasn't an officer, but we called him our liaison officer. He was a French corporal, and he was extremely good, a very good English speaker. And he did take groups of us from time to time to visit neighbouring French units who were very hospitable and very friendly. We had a high opinion of the standard of discipline and training of the French at that time. It was, of course, later difficult to judge once the Germans had broken through, because everything was fairly chaotic and it was easy to misjudge the standards of discipline and training of the French army. But I think, in fact, in our part of the world, they did their best.
Now, can we go on to the German attack on the 10th of May and what you personally remember of that?
I was in a train going to Boulogne on leave with a chum of mine called Hilary Glynn, and we arrived at Boulogne on the morning of the 10th to find on the station platform there were blackboards saying that all BEF personnel should return at once to their units and trains would be provided accordingly. So we turned back and went back up from Boulogne to Liévin, and on the 13th, we moved across the frontier and went up to Alost, just outside Brussels, which was as far forward as we got. Up to that time, and for the next 2 or 3 days, we were in a position to continue to do the supply task that we had for the troops in one corps, which was the quarter whom we were assigned, and that went quite smoothly. But after about 3 days, we began to find that although Corps Headquarters was extremely able at finding suitable locations for us, it was very difficult for us to keep contact with the units for whom we were responsible.
Did you get any air attack at this time?
The only air attack we had was when we were at Alost, and that was not on our own headquarters. It was on one of our detached platoons, and no damage was done. The only two bombs that were dropped fell into rather muddy ploughed fields, and we suffered no damage at that time.
Did you feel personally at this time that any kind of military disaster was impending?
The first I really felt that a military disaster was impending was when we turned about, having gone up to Alost. We had to back out and face south again because there was talk of this attack coming, a pincer movement coming from north and south around Arras, and we were prepared for that. But when that died out, and I happened to listen on my portable radio set, which I had with me, I happened to listen to the BBC to see what was going on, and I heard over the BBC, I heard the warnings that were coming that the BEF weren't doing all that, all the indications that the BEF weren't doing all that well and were being cut off. That was the thing that began to worry me. Interestingly enough, while I was listening to my radio set, I was surrounded by Belgian civilians, all of whom, of course, were extremely interested to know what was going on as well. They were assuring us that it would be all be well because the Belgians would hold out. But, of course, that proved to be untrue.
What are your next memories?
My next memories are when... my next memories, really, are of refugees. Refugees and Belgian soldiers on the move, holding up traffic, filling the roads, sad cases, of course, sad cases of families. I was going through Bayeul with our French liaison chap to visit one of our detachments when we had to drive along the pavement to get past the troops of refugees. And one child was unfortunate in falling off a cart, and the back wheels of the cart went over his legs, breaking both of them. The family in the cart went on. The French liaison officer told them that he would see that the boy got to hospital. That seemed to satisfy them. We took the boy into a staff car, took him to the nearest hospital in Bayeul, which was absolutely jam-packed with the sick and the wounded and so forth, and we just hoped that at some stage that boy would meet up with his family. That was the last I saw of him, or no doubt maybe the last that he saw of his family. It was a harrowing business to see all these refugees, and knowing, as one did, that all they were doing, of course, they were at that time they were moving south, and knowing that they were moving into yet another area of trouble. There was no answer for them, no solution for them.
What were the main problems that you had in doing your own job?
My own personal job was made extremely difficult then, of course, because the unit, because it was responsible for supporting a number of other units in one corps, the unit itself had got broken up into a series of detachments, and one of my jobs was to try to keep pace with them. And eventually, I had to give that up altogether, and I was merely supporting my CO in what he was trying to do to keep our headquarters and what was left of the unit intact and moving in accordance with the instructions we got, which, of course, were usually coming through late at night and asking us to move very fast.
Who was your CO?
My CO was a chap called Valder Gates of Cowan Gate, the baby food people. And he had been a regular soldier. He had retired to go into the family firm of Cowan Gate. He'd called up again, or volunteered again, the Second World War, and he was a dynamic sort of chap. He later went on to become the Heidi High Holy Ho Gates, which I don't know whether you know the story, but the Daily Mirror picked it up. After he came back from France, after Dunkirk, he got command of a training organization. And one of the things he used to do was to get his soldiers to respond very rapidly on parade to the shout of "Heidi hi." They had to reply very quickly, "Holy ho," to demonstrate they were on their toes. The idea was good, but it was unfortunate because, of course, as I say, the Daily Mirror got hold of it and made quite a thing about this was the way we were preparing our soldiers for the invasion, was to teach them to say "Holy ho" when somebody said "Heidi hi." But that was really unfair because he was a very able, very determined man. And when we got to Dunkirk, he got himself involved quite voluntarily off his own bat. He got himself involved with a sort of movement control exercise. He undertook to take part of the beach and try to organize some kind of arrangement whereby the soldiers coming onto that particular sector of the beach got off in the boats that were coming to take them. And as his adjutant, I was stuck with the problem of being with him. So I spent about 3 days on the beach at Dunkirk, when perhaps I might have been only there for one. But it was a very interesting experience, and I don't regret being there at all.
Can you tell me how you got to Dunkirk and what happened on the way, please?
We got to Dunkirk. Our last place was a place called Erkingham, on the road up towards Dunkirk. And the orders we received there were to destroy our vehicles, all but sufficient to carry the personnel to the perimeter of Dunkirk. And incidentally, one of the things we had done just previously to getting to Erkingham was to empty the very large NAFI, which was up in the Brussels area, which meant we had vehicles absolutely packed full of gin and whiskey and all sorts of joys of that kind. And so we had to destroy those by throwing cases of crates of whiskey and crates of gin onto the cobblestones of the farmyard, much to the entertainment of the farmer and his family. For one night, Hilary Glynn and I slept in a gin palace because we built ourselves a little shelter. It was raining. It was heavy mist and very damp that night. So we built ourselves a little shelter with crates of gin and a tarpaulin over the top. And it's the only time in my life I've ever slept in a gin palace. But from Erkingham, where we did get rid of a lot of our weapons, by smashing them with sledgehammers and that sort of thing. We did our best to smash the vehicles that we had to leave, again, sledgehammers and the engines, because we did have a workshops with us. We were able to do a certain amount of damage to them. We then drove to the perimeter of Dunkirk, and I went on ahead then with Valder Gates to see the town major of Dunkirk to see what we ought to do. And we found him in the town offices, very sensibly parked behind a piano in the room he'd taken over his office to give him some sort of protection from the bombing that was going on at the time. He was tucked in a corner of the room behind this piano, grand piano, and he was behaving in the most sensible and practical and cool manner. He knew exactly what he wanted to do with us and where we should go. He told us we could move forward from the perimeter with the minimum vehicles, just one staff car and one lorry with a certain amount of food in it, and a staff car so that we could move about if we had to do so. We went to Bray Duden, and Bray Duden, which is on the beach, about, I suppose, a couple of miles or so along the beach from Dunkirk itself, and we established ourselves in a bar alongside the bandstand, which is still at Bray Duden, because I went there fairly recently, and the bandstand is still there. We established ourselves in the bar to give ourselves some sort of home for the night, and from there we did our best to get troops afloat. I remember distinctly the arrival of a large number of French troops with their horses. And the sad thing was that they just seemed to leave their horses, when they got there, on the sand, and then took to themselves marching along the beach. And so we had a lot of horses wandering around looking rather lost, and what became of them I don't know. I'm rather sad. Hilary Glynn and I managed to get a few tins of chicken, which were in the bar that we took over. And with tin chicken and a bottle of Cointreau, we kept ourselves reasonably comfortable for the 3 days we were there. We did have some rations, but gin and Cointreau is a very good thing to do if you're ever benighted on a beach in wartime. There was a certain amount of dive bombing, ineffective in the main, because of course it was very sandy, and for the most part the bombs just went into the sand and blew up without a great deal of fuss and bother. Troops did their best, and it was good for their morale to shoot at the aircraft as they were flying over, but I don't suppose anyone brought any of them down. There was a considerable amount of grumbling, of course, because the RAF were not apparent, which is very unfair, because the RAF were doing their job elsewhere, trying to do their best to stop the dive bombers from reaching the target area. But there was And that had to be dealt with when we got back to this country. The troops had to be told that the RAF had, in fact, done their job. We progressed gradually along the beach once we'd finished this job of doing our best to get rid of as many troops as possible from the Bray Dune area. And we formed ourselves into parties of 20. And then came off via the Mole. I came off on the night of the 31st May on a cross-channel steamer to Dover. And one of the interesting things, incidentally, just before leaving the beach, was to find the number of people that I met up with. I met up with a couple of chaps I'd been at college with. I met up with a parson from Farnham, whom I'd known in my earlier days. It was quite strange. It was a sort of social gathering as people gradually came together towards the Mole. And at the head of the Mole, there was a British brigadier sitting in an armchair which he'd purloined or borrowed from a furniture store on the seafront at Dunkirk. And he had the armchair up on a table, so he was right up. And he had a megaphone, or loudhailer, and he was calling the parties forward to the Mole in an orderly fashion. And again, it was a most impressive sight to see this chap sitting there. I don't know how long he'd been there. I don't know who took over from him. I never identified who he was, although somebody said that he was from the Royal West Kents. That I'm not sure about. But it was a splendid piece of British phlegm, I thought. When we got to Dover in the morning, we were whisked via Headcorn, where the WRVS provided us with cups of tea and goodies, and where I was able to leave a note with one of the WRVS telling my parents that I was safe and sound, because, of course, they wondered where on earth I was. We went straight through from Headcorn to Bristol, and I spent the first night up on the downs at Bristol. We had a bath and a meal, very kindly provided by some people in Park Street, Bristol. I've been back to Bristol since, because that's where I worked when I left the army. And unfortunately, that house had disappeared, so I wasn't able to go and see those people again. We went from Bristol on the advice of a railway transport officer to Kingham in Oxfordshire, Hilary Glynn and I, because this is where we were told our unit was reforming. And there was nobody else with us at that time. People had got scattered in all sorts of places. So we went to Kingham, and we had an idyllic week in Kingham. It was a very nice, sunny June 1940. We had an idyllic week doing nothing, waiting for our chaps to arrive. And eventually we got a bit bored. We thought we'd do something about it, because nothing was happening. So we went back to the RTO at Kingham, and he said, "Oh, no," he said, "absolute nonsense. Your unit is forming in Malvern." So we went to Malvern. And that's where I found myself then commanding a thing called 10 Motor Coach Company RASC, whose coaches were things like the Brighton Blue and the Aldershot District Traction Company, this sort of thing. The object of the exercise being to provide these coaches, single-decker coaches, to move troops rapidly around the countryside in the event of invasion. There was no camouflage paint, and I'd been slung out from France. And I felt, really, that to be running a bus company was not what I'd joined the army for in the first instance. And at that time, the letter came round calling for volunteers for the commandos. The raising of the commandos is a very interesting thing, because the army normally moves slowly. And the army moved extremely fast over the commandos. The story goes that a chap called Dudley Clark in military operations at the War Office had a brainwave when he was walking home one evening that what a good idea it would be if we had some sort of troops to do raiding operations on the European coast in order to keep the Germans awake. And on the 4th of June, which was just one day really after operation ceased completely at Dunkirk, on the 4th of June, he wrote a little paper on this subject. He showed it to the CIGS, Dill, on the 5th of June. The CIGS liked it and showed it to Churchill on the 6th. Churchill gave it its OK on the 8th, and on the 9th of June a letter went out to all commands saying that volunteers were required for special operations and a knowledge of French would be an advantage and all this kind of thing, and preferably one should be able to swim and should be physically fit and so on and so forth. Now, I was in Malvern. I got my letter on the 14th of June. That is a letter to me as a unit commander saying that volunteers were called for. And so incidentally, Churchill wanted to call them leopards to begin with. That was the idea, not commandos. So I might well have gone round later on with leopard written on my shoulder rather than commando. But he got the name commando, of course, from that book written by Dennis Reitz about the commandos in the Boer War. Because of his experience in the Boer War, he knew all about that. And so that's where he got the title commanders from eventually. Anyway, I was interviewed in Salisbury by a chap called John Durnford Slater, a gunner who finished up as a brigadier commanding a commando brigade later in the war. And I was selected. My task then was to find to agree my two officers. He had two officers lined up for me. I agreed them. One was an infantryman and the other was a sapper. And my task then was to go and recruit my troop. In those days, a commando consisted of 10 troops, a troop of 60 men, two sections. And you had carte blanche. No unit could refuse. If somebody volunteered to join the commandos, there was no refusal part of the unit commander. What you had to be careful, of course, was to have a look at the conduct sheets of the chaps who were volunteering, because some of them, of course, were people that the unit would be perfectly happy to see go, and it was very important to get the right ones. I recruited mostly in Barton Stacey, where the engineers were, the forts overlooking Portsmouth, and the Isle of Wight. And I got a troop which consisted of a section of sappers, mostly from Barton Stacey, and that was a useful thing from a demolitions point of view. And I got a troop from the Isle of Wight and Portsmouth. We formed at Plymouth, and that was the first time that my two officers saw the chaps that I had selected for them. And naturally, the sapper took command of the sapper section, and the infantryman, a chap called Molesworth, who was later killed, unfortunately, in Burma, he took command of the infantry section. We had a very intensive training period at Plymouth, a lot of work in boats to get the chaps sea experienced and that sort of thing. And we used to carry out raids across the water on the little island that lies off Plymouth itself. And we had chaps going down to a place like Penzance, going out in drifters off the coast again to get a certain amount of sea experience. I was sent on a course to Loch Eilert, which was the Special Services Training Centre in Scotland, which was the home of the Stirling family, or relative of the Stirling family, the Stirlings, who of course started the SAS. And amongst the instructors there were people like Shimi Lovett, who finished up commanding four commando, Calvert, who was Mad Mike Calvert of the
Chindits,
whom you've already been discussing, I think, Dennis Gudgeon. Who else did we have there? Oh, yes, we had The Jungle is Green, Spencer Chapman, for a time. The Jungle is Neutral, rather, Spencer Chapman, for a time, before he shot off to